I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics.
This week, we're taking a deep dive into how the concept of religious freedom is understood using three recent stories from around the U.S.
And at the end of the episode, Nish talks to Rachel Esplin O'Dell and Jennifer Walker Thomas from Mormon Women for Ethical Government to gain some insight on issues that LDS women are passionate about, as well as their thoughts on civic engagement leading up to the midterms in 2020. We produce this podcast with the generous backing of individuals who support us every month. If you like what you hear and think these conversations are valuable, you too can become a sponsor of Impolite Company. We have some exciting ideas we want to pursue with this show, including an audio documentary and maybe even a movie watching event. But we need your help to make them a reality. Click the link in your player's episode description or visit patreon.com, that's patreon.com/impolitecompanypodcast to sign up.
This week, we're tackling the often controversial topic of religious freedom through a trio of stories that caught our eyes recently. The first is the news that the Trump administration will soon issue regulations expanding religious and moral exemptions for covering birth control coverage in employer health plans, essentially limiting the contraception mandate that was part of the ACA. Exact language hasn't yet been released, but the regulations are expected to vastly expand the universe of companies that can be allowed to ignore the mandate. Interestingly, they are also expected to redefine the exemption to include a, quote, strongly held moral conviction, unquote, that is not based in any particular religious tradition.
The second story comes from my home state of Michigan, where a pharmacist working at a large chain store, that's Meijer Thrifty Acres for those of you who are Michiganders, refused to fill a prescription a woman needed to complete a miscarriage she was already having. He also refused to transfer the prescription to a pharmacy that would fill the request. Both of these actions violated his company's policy, which requires a pharmacist who claims a religious objection to find another pharmacist who will fulfill the action instead. In this case, when the woman told the pharmacist she needed the medication because she was in the midst of having a miscarriage, he responded, "Well, that's your word, and I don't believe you."
The last story is a different twist on religious freedom and comes from Arizona, where an activist named Scott Warren was arrested in January for his work with a group that tries to provide life-saving supplies to migrants crossing from Mexico. As part of Warren's defense, he is claiming that his faith compels him to offer assistance to people in dire need. As NPR's report on the case noted, this sets out a clash between two of social conservatives' top priorities: cracking down on illegal immigration and defending religious liberty. It's a lot of religious liberty stuff here.
There's a lot going on. And before we get much further, I want to point out, as regular listeners will know, but maybe not everybody knows, that we've talked a lot about the impact of the contraception mandate and the ACA, and about the fact that particularly from a pro-life stance, it's notable that the increase in access to affordable and in some cases completely subsidized contraception seems to have led to an enormous and very noticeable drop in the abortion rates across the U.S. in virtually every state. So one of the things that I think is worth talking about when we're looking at regulations that are expected to limit the number of employers who would be required to cover birth control in their employer health plans, is that that would almost certainly result in more abortions. Because when you have fewer people having access to affordable contraception, we know that the unplanned pregnancy rate goes up. Sometimes that leads to an increase in birth rates, but it also leads to an increase in abortion rates.
Yep. I mean, we will beat this drum all the live long day. That all the live long day that access to affordable or free birth control lowers the abortion rate. So like the last story about, you know, the guy who provides aid to migrants crossing over the border and how it's setting up kind of a pit between cracking down on illegal immigration and defending religious liberty. It's kind of pitting those two things against each other. This also would seem at face value that it would pit decreasing the abortion rate and limiting access to birth control and expanding religious freedom. It would pit those two things together, but it seems like, especially now that they have Kavanaugh on the court and the court has swung to the far right, it seems like they kind of don't care. You know what I mean? They just don't care that birth control lowers the abortion rate when it's almost like it doesn't matter now that they have their guy in the court, because they're just going to make it illegal and try to overturn Roe anyway. So I don't know. It creates these really interesting political dynamics within the Republican Party that I'm interested to see how it plays out. But I don't know. It's kind of frustrating.
Well, and with both of these stories that involve contraception, both the new rules that are expected through HHS and the second story about the individual pharmacist who I didn't note in the lead-in is Catholic, and he when presented with this prescription for, and I will look at what the medication is, misoprostol, which is used to aid the completion of a miscarriage. And, again, in case it wasn't clear, this is a woman who very much wanted to have kids. She and her husband had been trying for a while. One of the extra details is they actually became pregnant with twins. The first one was not viable, and she carried what she thought was a viable other fetus until it just didn't show up in tests, and it became clear that she had a dead fetus inside of her, which is heartbreaking, but also extremely dangerous. The body does not do well with dead tissue and needs to get rid of it. And so her doctor had given her a number of choices, said, you know, we can do a DNC, an abortion procedure, to remove it. We can let your body try to remove it naturally, or we can induce a miscarriage. And she decided to try the natural route, and it just wasn't working. The risk of her body going into sepsis was getting greater and greater. And her doctor said, you know, you need to remove this. And so she happened to be on vacation in the northern part of the Lower Peninsula and tried to get this prescription filled, and just happened to run into a pharmacist who believed he knew better than she did. And he thought this was just some rogue woman trying to have an abortion, and he wasn't going to let her do it. In both of these cases, it strikes me that it's hard to avoid what is a charge that often comes from more secular liberals, that social conservatives just want to control women's bodies. I've spent a lot of my career arguing against that and trying to highlight sincere moral convictions.
Mm-hmm. Which there are some, and legitimately.
There are some, but as you say, when you pursue a policy that we know will lead to more abortions, and when you deny a woman medication she needs to protect her own health, and when there's no viable baby, there was no course of action that was going to result in a live birth here. That was not possible. And just go with the default, not believing women. We've talked a lot about not believing women lately, but this is another area where it's a problem. It is hard to avoid the conclusion that for at least some religious conservatives, these issues are about controlling women's choices and controlling their bodies and looking at them as primarily vessels of procreation. And that's dehumanizing. That is by its definition dehumanizing.
Yeah. It's It's also a fundamental misunderstanding of the role of birth control and reproductive health in the life of a woman, just in general, outside of birthing children.
Oh, thank you.
Whether, yes. So like, I have been on birth control long before I ever started having sex, because my period was so painful. I got migraines. Like, it was out of control. And frankly, it was one of the things going back on the pill after I had a child. Regulating my hormones was an integral part of normalizing my mental health. It was the thing that helped, you know, get me back onto equilibrium. There are so many aspects to a woman's biological way of being in the world and in their body that relies on medication sometimes. And sometimes the best medication for the things that are happening in our bodies happens to also work as birth control. Like, they can, this type of medication can serve multiple purposes, and they do for millions of women. Millions of women take birth control for other reasons besides controlling when they want to start a family or have a baby. It serves multiple purposes. It is a part of our comprehensive health. And to say that we're going to limit our access to elements of our comprehensive health is discriminatory. It is discriminatory based on sex. And which is why I'm super thankful that like the ACLU has stepped up and said, like, you can't expand some of these exemptions to this degree, because it's going to severely damage women and access to their health.
Especially because part of what we believe are the proposed regulations is that there would be no requirement to provide an alternative.
Right. They can just deny. Even,
you know, direct women to an alternative. It would be, nope, sorry.
Yeah. And then what do you do? Yeah. Like, and I know that so many people make this argument of like, well, just go find another job. Well, listen, buddy, that's not so easy. Like, it's not so easy when you have a really great, well-paying job and you have dependents and you're, you know, paying toward a mortgage to just like quit your job and go find something new because of your health insurance. And frankly, we shouldn't have to.
Insane, is it? Yes.
We shouldn't have to.
The quality of your health care is tied to the job that you happen to have. We are the only country that does this.
Single payer for all.
Go off into a whole different tangent on that.
Gotta get it out of employment.
But yeah, I'm really glad that you brought up the multiple uses of birth control, because I think it's something that people just choose not to pay attention to, or choose to ignore.
How nice that they can.
I don't know what it is, but as someone who used to pass out from the pain before getting on birth control, like, hormones are very helpful things. And yes, they serve multiple uses, but yeah, limiting, I mean, there have been many, many, many research studies done on women and pain, and the tendency of doctors to minimize and not believe women when they self-report pain. This is, you know, this is whole swaths of the government and the country choosing to minimize women's physical pain, not to mention emotional pain. And, just have no patience for it anymore.
The thing that really like is so frustrating to me is that the people that want to limit whether or not women can access birth control is the same party that keeps like banging the drum of small government, right? And like, I want the government out of my life as much as possible. Like, really? Do you? Because I'm pretty sure the government, by taking away my access to birth control, whether it's for, you know, my own health reasons, or frankly, if I just don't want to have a baby, the government is telling me through its regulations and through its ability to expand these sorts of things and like what it means to have a religious objection, is the is the epitome of big government and telling me what I can or cannot do with my body and the medication that I need for my body, or what whether or not I can plan when I want to have a kid. Like, it's just, it's so hypocritical. It's like the cognitive dissonance is deafening. It is so frustrating to me to hear people hammer on and on and on about small government, and yet expanding these objections to allow anybody to just deny someone the ability to plan a family or take control over her own personal health. It's bananas, which goes back to what you were saying, that like the secular left, you know, saying that like, no, this is all about Republicans wanting to control women's bodies. Like, it's a freaking salient argument. It really is.
Yeah, it's hard to push back against that these days.
It's really hard. It's really
and
hard.
And especially because, you know, I wish somebody would do another poll on this, but every time it has been polled over the last few decades, when you ask people whether it is moral to use contraception, mm-hmm. it is in the mid to high 90s.
Yeah.
In terms of the percentage of Americans who believe that contraception use is moral. So we're talking about a real percentage, but a extremely small percentage of people who simply believe that there is no difference between the use of contraceptives and abortions. There is a way, and we can talk about this in a little bit of detail, but the Obama administration muffed this up in its own way by choosing not to find the best way at the beginning to craft a good religious conscious exemption to cover just those folks, which has, in many ways, there was just, no pun intended, but there were bad faith arguments all around, enough to go around on all sides during the ACA debates that have gotten us to this point where we're not talking about people who hold this deeply held objection about the nature of contraception. We're talking about employers who have, as you said, Nish, sometimes a religiously based conviction, sometimes a moral conviction, not based in particular religious teaching. So I don't know even if there are any bounds to that objection. For employers who simply don't want to give women this benefit. And that is a completely different universe of objection to believing that covering this would be akin to funding abortions. You know, by the way, most insurers and many employers who have coverage that they pay for their employees, they prefer to cover contraception because guess what? It keeps costs down.
It keeps your healthcare costs down.
It's a lot cheaper to cover pills every month than it is to cover the cost of a pregnancy and a kid. Yes.
Because pregnancy and delivery and pediatric care is so expensive. It's so expensive. It's thousands upon thousands of dollars to have a baby in this country, which is an entirely different crazy category that it costs thousands of dollars to have a baby. But it does. Like, that's the reality. It costs thousands of dollars to have a baby in this country. And it is so much smarter for insurance companies to go, you know what? I would much rather pay the, you know, $20 or whatever it costs for a woman to get her package of birth control pills. Like, it's just crazy. It is crazy. Oh,
yeah. So, you know, it's something we can expect is going to happen with the Trump administration. I don't think there are any fail safes. They already had their comment period, and I'll have to look up the details and put this in the show notes. But I believe the vast majority of comments were, please don't expand this.
Yeah, please don't.
Nobody wants to be for this. Please don't do that.
Well, yeah, because I mean, like, if it includes like a broad, like, moral objection, like, what's to stop a company to be like, I just don't want to pay for it. Therefore, I'm just going to write that I have a quote unquote strong moral objection. Like, what?
Well, and the precedent test there for other medical procedures,
right?
That you may have an objection to.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is something that should bother more people.
Everybody.
Than I pay attention to it right now.
Everybody.
And this last story out of Arizona surprised me because I have been wondering, I thought that the clash for social conservatives was going to be if ICE decided to go after an immigrant who was being given cover by a sanctuary church.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's where I thought that the kind of mania of going after illegal immigrants was going to clash with religious liberty. This is something I didn't see coming, but it's interesting. The group that Scott Warren in Arizona works with, I believe it's called No More Deaths. And they're not saying immigration is great, bring everybody over. They're saying people are going to keep coming because life is hard. And already, again, there have been people fleeing political violence. And it would be nice if they didn't die on their way over. So we're going to leave them water and food. That's what they're trying to do, is just prevent deaths from people coming over the border. And if migrants are then arrested and sent back, well, you know, that's not a piece of their work, which, you know, I would define as pro-life, but I clearly don't get to define that.
Who even knows what that means anymore? Pro-life. But yeah, I think, I mean, this is a really fascinating case. And the first thing that I have to say is this guy saying that my faith compels me to do this. I just want to like stand on top of whatever roof is closest and say amen. Like, thank you. Thank you. Like, what a refreshing perspective to say, like, my faith compels me to make sure that these people have food and water. Like, I cannot look away to the plight of these, you know, fellow image bearers. They are image bearers. They are children of God. And that this guy would go out and like fight it and say, no, like, this is religious freedom. This is me outwardly practicing an inward belief, right? And that that right is protected. It's protected. And I'm super interested to see exactly how they're going to fight this one. Because for a group that is really hell-bent on religious freedom, this will test whether or not they actually, I mean, there are, I shouldn't even say it should test. There have been a lot of tests in which they have clearly failed about what religious freedom actually means, and that it's just religious freedom for some and not religious freedom for all. But this will be another one of those tests that determines what exactly are we talking about when we talk about religious freedom. Are we talking about religious freedom for everybody? And even if they don't align with our political beliefs.
Not religious progressiveness.
No.
That nope. doesn't count.
Nope. So I'm really
Poor
interested
Muslims.
To see how it plays out. No, not.
Or,
definitely. Yes,
yeah.
not. Because not only are they Muslims, they're brown people. And obviously, golly, this freaking administration is going to give me a hernia. So... Yeah, I'm super interested to see how they fight this and what the Justice Department says. But only time will tell. But it's a fascinating case. Like you, I didn't see it coming. Really didn't see it.
Yeah. We'll try to pay attention to that. It was just a twist of fate that I happened to be in the car in time to hear All Things Considered and heard the report.
Nice.
But before we give Nish a hernia.
on. Please don't.
We talk a lot about faith outreach and civic engagement among people of faith on this show. So we were delighted to get an interview with two leaders from a nonpartisan organization doing exciting work, engaging Mormon women nationwide on issues of immigration, refugees, and more. Here is Nish's interview with Rachel and Jennifer from Mormon Women for Ethical Government.
I'm so excited to have Rachel Esplin Odell and Jennifer Walker Thomas from Mormon Women for Ethical Government on the show. You may have heard the name of the organization during the Kavanaugh nomination process. Mormon Women for Ethical Government, or MWEG for short, is a nonpartisan group dedicated to the ideals of decency, honor, accountability, transparency, and justice in governing. It was started by Mormon women, is led by Mormon women, but is open to all women. Rachel and Jennifer, thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm so happy you're here.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. Okay. So can you guys explain to me, how did the organization get its start? Where did it come from and why now?
So if ever an organization grew organically, this one did. It started as a response, sort of a visceral response in the days immediately following the 2016 election by a group of women who were longtime friends and peers. And just were chatting online about how they felt they wanted to respond to some of the issues raised in the election and some of the problems that they saw might result from that election. So they started chatting, and within a couple of days had sort of started this organization, and it started simply virally on Facebook. It was a closed group, and friends would reach out to friends, and it quickly expanded into the thousands over a matter of just days and weeks, and originally was just simply a closed discussion group on Facebook where women could talk specifically about issues, respond to articles, and kind of begin to formulate how they felt about the way the country was going. It became very clear shortly thereafter that if you have that many people that are this engaged and are this interested and have a strong desire to make a difference, that it was probably, it probably would do more good if we started to exercise our muscles to do some action rather than to just sit around chatting about the things that we saw that were problematic. And so a structure sort of began to form from there, responses to particular needs. And the organization has just, again, evolved organically over, you know, the last year and a half to meet the needs that we saw and to respond to basically also the capacity of the women who were willing to engage.
That's fantastic. What sort of issues did these women talk about specifically? What were sort of the big things that kind of came up? Was it the president-elect specifically? Was it issues of sexual assault? Was it immigration? What are some of the things that these women are really passionate about?
Well, in the very first days, I think the most visceral response was specifically to the Muslim ban. It became very clear that the administration was going to start making delineations about people's desirability in the country based simply on their religion. And that did not sit well with many of the women who had joined. And so I think that was our first sort of pivotal issue that we all rallied around and said, you know, regardless of how you feel about national security or regardless of how you feel about some of the underlying issues, the methods that were being used were something that we were not super comfortable with as a group. And so I think that was the first hot button issue that people rallied around and responded to.
Yeah, I think that more generally over coming months and over the past almost 2 years, immigration and refugees and also the Muslim visa ban, and that kind of that general bucket of issues related to, you know, how welcoming are we as a nation of people that, you know, are not American or are not of our particular religious faith or the dominant or the majority religious faith in America, or, you know, ethnic racial group. I think those are issues that really have continued to motivate us. So that's where we've done a lot of work is on, you know, we did a lot with the family separation crisis, but really our immigration advocacy has gone back to the very beginning.
Yeah, I would agree with Rachel. I think that one underlying theme that has sort of run through everything, and perhaps that's just been a uniquely female response, I don't know if I should say that, but has been a distaste for policies or actions that seem to burden people who could not protect themselves or were the underdog or kind of had a minority status, that was problematic for a lot of the women in the organization. And so we've rallied around things like that, that just where policy did not strike us as fundamentally fair.
Yeah. Talk to us about like the role of your LDS or Mormon faith, that how does your faith, how does the doctrine of the church play into a lot of your policy issues or your concerns that you have about our government? What are sort of the driving forces of faith behind a lot of your actions?
So I guess I'll just pick up on this issue of immigration and the Muslim visa ban. I think that part of why this hit such a nerve among Mormon women, among women who are members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, is it has to do with both our own history and with certain stances that have been taken by current and recent church leadership. So, Mormons in the 1800s were persecuted and kind of driven from place to place in our early history and eventually to the Salt Lake Valley. And that was on the basis of our religion. And then that continued for several years when there was a lot of opposition to how Brigham Young was running things in Utah Territory. Some of this had to do with polygamy. It gets complicated because we don't practice that anymore. And so, but nonetheless, there was a lot of opposition by the government and direct persecution of Mormons for their beliefs. And so I think that that's why, why Latter-day Saints can relate to this, some of the concerns on some level faced by Muslim Americans and those, seeking to visit our country on the basis of that faith, because we had experienced that in the past. And so I think, in part because of that history, our church leadership in recent years has also strongly emphasized religious freedom and the need for that to extend to people of all religious faiths, of all religious groups. And so they have issued statements specifically, in defense of the rights of Muslim Americans and the need to, and even during the election, there was an occasion where it wasn't a direct rebuke of President Trump, but in response to the issues in response to some of the comments or issues he was bringing up about wanting to have, I can't remember specifically, but the Muslim database or whatever he had advocated, the Latter-day Saint Church or the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints had issued some statements about that. So I think that, and then not to mention immigration, the LDS Church has done a lot on immigration, and in Utah and more broadly. And so I think that provided a path, or it eased the way for Latter-day Saint women to become really, to be able to empathize on these issues and become engaged.
I actually remember, I think it was around the time that the Muslim ban started to make some headway, was around the time that I believe it was during the women's conference of the LDS Church's general conference, where there was a push to welcome refugees and work with refugees. Is that right? Those things kind of coincided at the same time. I thought that was really remarkable. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I think definitely, again, the refugee work for many women stemmed from that talk and that particular conference. Mm-hmm. And I think that it just was born of this, and it was a way for us to continue onward. At a certain point, depending on where you live, you tap out, particularly in Utah, on the ability to help a certain group of refugees because you're sort of top heavy with Mormons. But if you've internalized that message, then it's very easy to look more broadly and say, well, I can see how these people are individually suffering, and you can take a step towards saying, well, I can see how this policy will actually harm these people that I've come to love and care about. And so I think that if women hadn't been called to engage so directly and personally with refugees, there might not have been the same visceral response to policy issues, because you kind of have to, if you've never been involved in politics, the best gateway drug is meeting someone that is helped or hurt by particular policies. And then you start to see how those things, how the macro level impacts the micro level. And so I think for Mormon women, that sort of moment in time was fairly pivotal.
Okay. Yeah. And in fact, our current senior director over one of our organizational limbs, we can talk more about our organizational tree in a bit, but Molly Hogan, she wrote an op-ed about this early on. One of the things we do is really encourage women to write, to share their voices and their experiences. And she spoke specifically to this. She talked about how, getting involved with or getting to know refugees and immigrants in her own neighborhood And some of this was just she happened to have a job that made it so she interacted, had those interactions more. Some of it was also in a church context. Anyway, how that is what part of her inspired her to get more involved in advocacy on a more political level, on a policy level. And now she's over the part of MWIG that is really doing the most, that does our lobbying. And so she lives in the DC area and does a lot of that. And it's really was inspired in part by that personal experience.
Let's shift gears just a little bit. You did kind of mention the organizational structure of MWEG. I would like to talk about that because it's fascinating to me to watch something that really is so organic and grassroots that started really on Facebook. How in the world did you manage to create this organization out of a Facebook group? How does that work? Because you are not the first one that that's happened to. I can think of a couple of big women's organizations that kind of were born out of the election that really kind of took root and got some organization. How did you guys go about doing that? How does the organization look now moving forward?
So the organization is actually incredibly unique structurally. And Rachel hinted at that. I think that it's hard to articulate without sort of a visual alongside to explain how different it is. But it is, I believe, actually reflective of how women often organize sort of absent, or at least maybe Mormon women, I don't know, perhaps it's just unique to us, but organize absent a hierarchical structure. It's incredibly collaborative. It is not hierarchical or authoritative, but the structure itself is balanced between sort of at its root, the ideological ideas that we are determined to both defend and to use as our personal motivators. And then we've got sort of an operational structure that links that to the active portion. And we visualized it as a tree. So there are four limbs to that tree, the trunk, which is the operational support, and then the four roots, which are the ideal that kind of feed the tree from an ideological standpoint. And the power, for lack of a better word, is sort of shared amongst women. There isn't really right now a big boss. We collaborate and we talk and we come to conclusions as an executive committee about how we're going to proceed.
So this tree emerged organically, no pun intended, but it kind of emerged out of so initially, so we had this group of founding members, founding women who organized Mormon Women for Ethical Government, and in particular, Charlie Mullins Glenn had been really, you know, working with these other women who are heavily involved in founding it to try to come up with a way to make the organization more sustainable moving forward. And that's where, you know, I think she writes in a book called The Little Purple Book that MWIG published earlier this spring through BICOM and Consent Press that has a lot of our sort of founding documents. She writes about how, you know, I think it was on a walk one day where she saw a tree and it just, you know, she felt like she received inspiration that this was, you know, how MWIG should organize itself moving forward. And so that has kind of unfolded over time. So we have these four roots in our four core attributes: faithful, peaceful, nonpartisan, and proactive. And then we have our four limbs, which are the organizational kind of sectors of MWIG. So we have Encircle, Educate, Empower, and Engage. And Encircle really deals a lot with membership. It's where, you know, I'm actually the senior director of the Encircle limb, and Jennifer is the senior director of the nonpartisan root. But so in Circle, that's where I kind of manage the Facebook group and do a lot with in terms of, you know, fellowshipping and recruiting members. Educate is where our committees are housed, and we do a lot of education on various issues. We have committees that deal with a wide range of issues. And then Empower seeks to empower women who are interested in getting more involved in politics through things like running for office or local, getting involved in local issues. And that's where our chapters are housed. We have chapters in nearly every state. And then Engage is our sort of advocacy and lobbying limb. So as Jennifer mentioned, the trunk and the core in the middle is where a lot of the administrative and organizational functions are taking place.
And then the roots, in case your listeners are interested, are based on our four attributes: faithful, nonpartisan, peaceful, and proactive. And the faithful is the part that makes us uniquely Mormon. We obviously operate on principles of Christian leadership and Christian belief, but they also are definitely colored by our Mormonism, and we are committed to adhering to the policies and doctrines of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The nonpartisan is fairly important to us. It's very important to me, obviously. But the sense that we maintain, it doesn't mean that we don't have ideological viewpoints or that we don't argue for certain beliefs, but it does mean that we are committed to not aligning with a particular party or advocating for particular candidates. Peaceful is also very important to us. It's the way we do business. And we think that in this particular climate, it's very unique. It's that we're guided by a set of principles of peacemaking that as members of MWEG we adhere to. It's how we try to discourse with each other. It's how we try to discourse with the outside world. And we try to have our conversations in a very specific way that is not as if we are going to war. And then finally, proactive is this. None of the thinking does much good if we're not in Mormon terms, anxiously engaged in a good cause and making a difference. So we're sort of drawing from those four ideas and trying to make sure that those four ideas are always represented in the activities that Rachel mentioned that are happening in the limbs.
I want to talk about a little bit about that peaceful aspect. The organization broke through in the news during the Kavanaugh nomination. There were some reports actually that were circulated that representatives from MWEG met with Senator Jeff Flake's office during those final few days and may have had a hand in his initial change of heart. Talk to me about that process and MWEG's involvement, particularly in that process.
So, it emerged definitely, I think, from two responses. The first was sort of a visceral. I don't think we had taken any position. Well, we had not taken any position on Kavanaugh as a candidate for this office prior to the issues being raised by Dr. Blasey Ford about sexual assault. And once that happened, we felt a particular concern that those issues be raised in order to maintain the legitimacy of ultimately the court and his seat on the court, that they needed a full hearing. And that was what drove us to initially become, you know, engaged around this. Wasn't particular advocacy for a certain ideological viewpoint, but it was just concern that an issue central to how many women experience life had been raised and it needed to be addressed. Rachel, do you want to expand on that?
Yeah. So, you know, I think that, you know, we felt, you know, pretty strongly that, of course, all of our members have their own political views, but we try not to take a stance on an issue unless we feel like it has a very clear ethical implications. And this was one where, you know, if Kavanaugh were to be confirmed without an actual nonpartisan or independent investigation of these allegations, that would be a clear ethical violation. It was a clear ethical red line. So, but as part of this, there was a sense that, you know, the issue of sexual assault, especially as a women's organization, you know, was one that did speak to us in particular. So, Charlie Mullins Glenn, she mentioned in an interview with the New York Times that on this issue that she had sort of polled our leadership team about our experiences of sexual assault. And this was something that around two thirds of our group had experienced. And so I think it was that kind of conversation that we had that really provided the impetus for us to take action. So there was this personal visceral component, as well as a sense that it crossed a clear ethical red line if an investigation wasn't undertaken. So and especially not just as women, but as women of faith who, you know, were in a faith that teaches that sexual abuse and sexual assault are clear violations and are, you know, they're clear violations of the, you know, sanctity of women and of basic fundamental principles of human dignity, and that they, you know, that they need to be taken really seriously.
Yeah, when someone, I mean, part of this idea of peacemaking is that you see suffering as sort of something that you have a sacred duty to engage with. So if mm-hmm. someone is suffering and represents a group of people that are suffering, then we feel an obligation to at least engage and find out what's happened and see that their needs are met and that they do not suffer further harm. And I think that was part of our concern around engaging with this issue.
Yeah. Shifting gears, I want to look ahead to 2020. I can't believe we're actually even talking about it already, but here we are. Midterms are upon us, and obviously we're going to look ahead to 2020 as soon as those pass. How do you see MWEG being involved in the election process moving forward? Do you have plans to mobilize, be doing voter outreach or any sort of faith outreach on these sort of ethical issues that you find important? What is the plan for 2020, if there is any?
I mean, right in terms of election outreach, I'll just say that with the midterm elections, we have a major initiative oriented towards voter preparation and registration and education. So we have, this has multiple components, and we will continue that effort and, likely expand it ahead of the 2020 elections. So this has involved a lot of voter registration drives, especially on campuses like at BYU, to get younger voters registered. And it's also entailed some candidate forums with especially some members of Congress, but also just local and state elections where we've just asked candidates to come and invited them from all the different parties, nominated candidates to come and just speak about the issues. And then our biggest push is around voter preparation parties, where we're encouraging our members of MWEG, as well as others interested in doing so, to hold voter preparation events in their own homes. And we've prepared a lot of materials to enable them to do that so that they can fill out worksheets that help them understand who's running for office, what issues are on their ballot. They're nonpartisan. They're not really, these aren't forums for debate or persuasion, but more for people to come together and just get involved and better understand and be better educated voters. So that's our, guided by, I guess, our nonpartisanship. That's the kind of emphasis we've chosen to adopt. And some of this is within a faith context. So some women have actually had activities in church. So Relief Society activities. The Relief Society is the name of the women's organization in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And some of these women have, gotten together with their fellow Relief Society sisters to talk about, go through a sample ballot or talk about issues. And in other cases, that might be seen as a little more sensitive or not really appropriate to do in a church setting, even though it's a nonpartisan event. So sometimes people will just do them on their own in their homes, but oftentimes they're still inviting people through their church network. So it does have that kind of faith-based component to it.
I also think that in terms of 2020, we are to some degree, because we are nonpartisan, a reactive organization. We're not sort of a Mormon's version of Emily's List. And so while we are encouraging women, and particularly women of our faith, to run for office, we're not directing them in terms of what we hope their ideological bent will be. But what we are doing is trying our best to empower and educate hopefully a group of women who have not been politically engaged before and have felt insecure about entering the political fray in a time of kind of difficulty and contention, but they internally feel a need to do so, but aren't sure how. And so as an organization, I think one of our most important roles that we have to play, particularly with women of our faith, is to lay out a pattern for them about how they can become informed about the policies that are being enacted around them, give them opportunities to engage in polite and reasoned discourse in sort of a safe space where they can do so knowing that the people that are discussing these things with them share their faith. And then hopefully as they learn to do those things, they can expand outward and engage with the broader world with confidence and knowledge. So I think that while we are not advocating for particular candidates, we feel strongly that our job is to educate and empower a group of women who previously were not educated and empowered, and doing that in a way that makes the political process and political knowledge accessible to them and, frankly, palatable to them.
Yeah. It seems like really, instead of the partisan angle, you're just simply talking to women of faith about the importance of civic engagement and
Absolutely.
What that means.
And teaching them and modeling for them. It's sort of interesting, and I'm sure you've experienced this, how very little of our political discourse now is not deeply and profoundly partisan. Oh, there are all sorts of trigger words. There are all sorts of ways that people talk that they have lost the idea to discuss ideas without discussing party and partisanship. Mm-hmm. And we feel strongly that at this point, we're not going to be able to move forward as a nation unless a significant portion of our citizenry can disengage from that partisan mindset. Now, that doesn't mean you have to leave parties or not participate in a party. But if you allow the party to blindly determine all of your actions and all of your thought processes, then we are never going to arrive at a point where we can discourse across the aisle. And so hopefully by modeling this for women, and it's a lot harder than it sounds, we have to work on this actively in our own discussion group, where you would think there would be just, you know, a lot of similarity in ideas. It slips in the way you talk to people, the way you make judgments and make assumptions based on one statement that a person you made, you make a whole assumption about a set of their beliefs. Mm-hmm. And that's really a problematic part of our politics today. So that is one of our big focuses, is helping women to go beyond that and learn to be nimble intellectually, be able to see multiple sides of an issue, be able to inhabit the space that someone else is living in, whether or not you agree with them, that you can go to a place where you can understand them and understand their motivations and assume goodwill in the process.
How can, this is my last question, where can people find you? How can people become involved, women specifically? I know you said you're open to women of all faiths, and these sorts of ideas really do have a broad appeal. I know a lot of women particularly are like, I want to engage, but I'm not really comfortable with either party and either platform, but I really do, you know, value civic engagement. I want to get involved, and they are women of faith. What are the ways in which women can get involved with MWEG? What are some of the access points for you guys? What sort of events do you have coming up? Tell us everything. How can we find you?
Yeah. So thanks for asking. We would love to have any women listening come and join us in Mormon Women for Ethical Government, whether or not you're Mormon. You can go to our website at MormonWomenForEthicalGovernment.org. or MWEG.org, they both will work, and click on the join tab, and there you can sign up. We will then add you to the Facebook group, to our Facebook discussion group, if you'd like to join that. And we'll also send you email updates on what we're working on, calls to action that we're issuing to our members. You can also find more information there about how to organize a voter preparation party ahead of the election, either this election or future elections. And, you know, use some of the materials that we prepared for that. You can also follow us on our various public platforms. So, you know, in addition to our website, you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and our public Facebook page at Mormon WEG. That's MORMONWEG is our handle. And we'd love to have more women of other faiths or of no faith, you know, coming and joining us in this work that we're engaged in.
I think one of the nice things about the organization right now is it offers women a huge range of opportunities. Because we are young, because we are growing, you can engage simply by committing to periodically get on the Facebook page and actively discuss issues in an intelligent and, you know, meaningful way. Or you can respond to our calls to action, which have been as small as contacting Congress, you know, representatives, or as large as calling people to engage really actively when a crisis is happening, say with children being held at the border. And we also are very enthusiastic about people who are willing to bring their skills to the table and help on the back end. It has been a remarkable thing to see a group of women come together in a space where they can openly dialogue, engage using the full weight of their talents and strengths and skills to accomplish a joint cause. And it has been inspiring, I think, both Rachel and I, in really remarkable ways, to see what happens on the back end and how many people are sacrificing and working to move this work forward. And we are willing to accept volunteers who want to do that as well. So we welcome women who want to participate and learn how to participate, and then learn how to act.
That's fantastic. And you also have an event coming up in Salt Lake City, is that right? In conjunction with By Common Consent. And I think Julia Ritchie from KUER is going to moderate a discussion.
Yes,
is that right?
Yes, that's right. And that will be an excellent conversation. It's going to be focused on it's sort of a book event, but also more broadly talking about the principles of peacemaking that we referred to earlier that are articulated in that little purple book that BICOM Consent Press published. So they're doing this event in Salt Lake, and it will be a panel of MWIG members and leaders who are going to talk about how they implement the principles of peacemaking in their own lives. So how this actually enables them to engage in effective and ethical advocacy work. And just to better get involved in trying to make our society a better place.
I think we are definitely evangelical for peace in the sense that as we've thought about it, and, you know, in the last few weeks, there has been obviously a lot of outrage and fear generated as women realize that perhaps their needs sometimes are not being met by their political leadership. Mm-hmm. But we have thought and talked a lot about the way you affect long-term and lasting change. And rage and fear can get you up out of your chair and they can send you on a really rapid sprint, but they rarely propel you through a marathon. And we're trying to empower women so that they have the personal strength and the intellectual strength to engage passionately and actively, but over a long term, that they can engage in the marathon living in a democracy and participate fully in ways that make meaningful change with the knowledge that that very rarely happens overnight, that it takes a lot of people joining together to push to make the rock roll up the hill. And we have found personally, and we found as an organization, that anger and fear can only push us so far, and that we have to find a motivating factor and a process. And for us, it is the motivating factor is love for our fellow humans and a process that involves peace that allows us to do this actively and for a long time over rough terrain.
Well, here's to the long haul.
Yeah.
Right? Rachel and Jennifer, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was a delight to have you both. I'm really excited to see where MWIG heads and what is ahead for your future.
Thank you so much,
it's going to be really exciting.
Thank you for having us.
And we'll wrap up the show with our praise and petition segment, in which we shout out the things that are bringing us joy and call out the people and situations who are making us cranky. Nish, what's going on with you this week?
Well, this week we did the pumpkin patch thing. Hashtag fall crap. This is my hashtag of choice when we go do pumpkin stuff and all the fall festivities. And I have to tell you, just something that brought me joy was there were two dudes dressed as Spider-Man and Hulk at this pumpkin patch. Oh, you can imagine, you know, Scout lost her mind. She very promptly went up to Spider-Man and proceeded to tell him all of these things about himself. Like, did you know that you got bit by a spider? Did you know that you can climb walls? Did you know that you tried to fight Thanos? Did you know? Like, she just like started going all the way down the list of things about Spider-Man. And she was like so delighted. And then of course Hulk was there and she got a big hug from Hulk. And she was excited to learn that Spider-Man's favorite Star Wars movie was The Last Jedi. Like, she was just like so excited. She just was thrilled. And so I was just reminded sometimes, like, the imagination and wonder of kids is such a beautiful antidote to cynicism and darkness. You know what I mean? Like, when the world feels really heavy, go spend time with a little kid. Like, it is just such a joy. And let's see, the other thing, pop culture-wise, recommendation. I watched this stand-up comedy on Netflix from Kamau Bell. It was so funny. Like, so, so funny. And, like, heartwarming. It was very deeply political. So if you're not into political comedy, probably not your fave. But he is really sharp, just really engaging. He talked about his kids a lot and his wife and being in interracial marriage. Raising interracial kids. It was just really, really smart and really funny. I laughed openly a few times while folding laundry. So definitely check it out. It is on Netflix, and I will put the title of it in the show notes for sure.
All right.
What about you? What do you have?
Well, we have also been visiting apple orchards and cider mills. I was in Michigan with the kids this past weekend, and the weather did not work out for us to go to the best cider mill that there is, Franklin Cider Mill. But we stopped yesterday on our drive back at the Dexter Cider Mill outside of Ann Arbor. And that was a pretty acceptable runner-up. It's right on a river, and so is actually an old mill. I have no space in my life for places that call themselves cider mills and are not actually mills. Get out.
Very passionate about this.
So the kids got to have their apple turnovers and cider donuts little, you know, individual servings of cider and hot cider. And that's just the smells of fall, the tastes of fall. Also, we had a successful football game, University of Michigan against Michigan State this weekend. And Cormick has out of nowhere become a big Michigan fan. So he is for the third day in a row wearing his little Michigan warm-up pants to school.
Yes.
And my parents got him a big Block M t-shirt, and he is proudly, he didn't want to zip up his coat today, even though it was like 39 degrees, because he wanted to show everybody his Michigan gear.
He wanted to sport that hard.
Yeah.
That's so awesome.
So we are pleased about that. We just got to teach the kids the Hail to the Victors song because they don't quite have it.
And then the conversion will be complete.
Exactly. And
that's awesome.
Not entirely in pulp culture, but something that I listened to on the drive back to Michigan on Thursday night was season 2 of the Slow Burn episode from Slate.
Oh, yeah.
Which covers the Lewinsky scandal.
Yep. That whole season's so good.
Yeah. I was not going to listen because, fun fact about me, one of my jobs after my first round of grad school was researching how the press covered the Lewinsky story and helping a professor write a book about what that said about changes in political journalism. So I have read pretty much everything that has been published about Monica Lewinsky and about this particular saga and about the Star Report. And I really didn't want to hear it again. But it was a good reminder, listening back, that some of us had complicated feelings about Bill Clinton from the very beginning. And at the time, I felt like I was being a traitor to feminists, or I was being a bad Democrat. But I feel vindicated from since then. Because as everyone has been saying, the last episode on Juanita Broderick is just incredibly difficult to listen to. And I am glad that we are in a different space 20 years later. At the same time, it's also really difficult to listen to the episode about social conservatives and to hear somebody like Bill Bennett, who was, I think, saying the right things about Bill Clinton. I think that although we should not look to our presidents to be our moral leaders, that's not the same as saying our presidents shouldn't be people with moral leadership.
That's right.
If that makes sense. They're not the person we look to, but we should be able to expect that our presidents have a good moral worldview. And, I agreed with Bill Bennett in the 90s when he criticized Clinton, and Bill Bennett is now one of the people who is a proud supporter of Donald Trump and who has apparently left at the wayside all of the critiques that he used in the 90s. You know, I want to hold feminists to account that if there was something that came up about a Democratic candidate or a Democratic president like Clinton now, that we would be able to see through partisan ends and be tough on them. But I think it's equally important to challenge social conservatives, as we have been over the past few years, and say, you know, forget your ridiculous King Darius arguments. Like, what are you telling your children about what they can learn from Donald Trump and what kind of a leader he is and how he acts and how he treats people?
Yeah. Well, there's that. Yeah, there's a lot to say there. We should unpack that. We should unpack a lot of the dichotomies between the Clinton age and now, and the transformation that so many social conservatives seem to have made very conveniently.
That would be good. I think we could also do an episode on parenting children in faith and during the Trump age, because there's a lot that's really difficult about that.
Yes. I do have one more plug. I am speaking at the Evolving Faith Conference this coming weekend. It's a conference put on by friends of the pod, Rachel Held Evans and Sarah Bessie, and I'll be speaking alongside some good friends and colleagues, Jen Hatmaker, Jeff Chu, Austin Channing Brown, Sandra Van Opstel, Mike McCargue, some really, really good folks. So there is a live stream available. You can go to evolvingfaithconference.com and sign up for the live stream. But you can hear me talk about evolving faith and politics. Yay. And I'm going to try not to just scream for 20 minutes from the main stage. I'm going to try really hard.
For that as well.
I will do my best. All right, that's all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please, please, please rate us on iTunes. It's the very best way to let other people know about us. And if you'd like to support the show, check out our Patreon page and consider supporting us financially so we can continue to expand these conversations. Until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids.